2 days ago, we celebrated the 70th anniversary of arguably the largest military operation in history with D-Day. I think I heard something about 150,000 soldiers were amassed off the coast of France to take on 50,000 Nazi soldiers in what became to be a watershed moment in World War II, a turning point in that conflagration. And you know from whatever history class you may have taken that World War II was the bloodiest war in human history, that the estimates are somewhere on the order of 60 million people, or almost 3% of the world's entire population, perished. And the predominant share of them had nothing to do with the fighting. It's just staggering to consider that amount of loss of life in that short amount of time. And therefore, you can understand why that is in large part why philosophers and theologians and politicians were scrambling to consider what could be done to prevent something like that happening again, where humanity would come to be seen as a hindrance to a way. Why something like Stalin would say one death is a tragedy, but a million deaths is a statistic. How can something like that occur, and also, more so, how could it be prevented? And that's why on the front of your bulletin is, as I mentioned in the backstory this week, a Lebanese Christian, a philosopher, a writer, a public intellectual by the name of Dr. Charles Habib Malik. He was instrumental in the composition and the ratification of a document that would outline human rights. It was called the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and it was adopted by the UN in 1948. Explicitly, it puts forth 30 chapters about what it believed all humanity was entitled to. But of course, in the Declaration of Human Rights, it is implying that if there are rights, there are also responsibilities. That if a human has a right, then other humans have a responsibility to preserve that right. We've been in a series on the Ten Commandments now for several weeks. We are in that segment of the commandments that you might say outlines explicitly or implicitly human rights, but more explicitly human responsibilities. The sixth commandment this morning that we'll talk about, I think, is the foundation for that divine declaration of human rights, that divine declaration of human responsibilities. Now, call me crazy, but I am fairly confident that none of you in this room will ever start a geopolitical battle. I'm fairly certain of that. Unless you're hiding from us certain skills and you know, powers and influence that I'm not aware of. But brothers and sisters, you have as much propensity to start wars of different kinds on smaller scales that requires you to understand what your responsibilities are to one another. We're going to look at the sixth commandment. We're going to look at Jesus' commentary on the sixth commandment from the Sermon on the Mount. And we're going to learn three things that perhaps outline our responsibilities to one another in God's sight. Three things: the potency of words, the dignity of humanity, and the priority of reconciliation. The potency of words, the dignity of humanity, and the priority of reconciliation. So let's stand, let's read the commandment, let's listen to Jesus' commentary from Matthew 5. Would you stand? First, in Exodus chapter 20, verse 13, Exodus 20, verse 13. You shall not murder. And then in Matthew chapter 5, starting in verse 21. You have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be liable to judgment. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council. And whoever says, you fool, will be liable to the hell of fire. So if you're offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First, be reconciled to your brother, and then come and offer your gift. Come to terms quickly with your accuser while you're going with him to court, lest your accuser hand you over to the judge and the judge to the guard and you be put in prison. Truly, I say to you, you'll never get out until you've paid the last penny. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. You may be seated. Lord Jesus, the words are unequivocal and too exacting, and we must know a way forward in them. And we ask that by your Spirit and through these frail words that you would chart that way. In Jesus' name, amen. Jesus has three things to tell us about our responsibility to one another. And the first of these is that words have an intrinsic and indispensable, indissoluble potency. As I said in the backstory this week, the sixth commandment in Exodus runs a whole number of two words. No killing. That's what it says. Lo ratzach. Right? There are many words in the Old Testament in Hebrew that refer to killing of different kinds. Ratzach refers to premeditated killing, that's murder, but also manslaughter, killing not necessarily by premeditation, but simply by negligence. So it has those connotations to it. But if you've read the Sermon on the Mount before, you know that several times in that sermon, Jesus is going to say, you've heard this said, but I say this. And in those instances, it's tempting to think that Jesus is beginning to overturn what's come before. Like, that was then, hey, this is now, listen to me. In fact, and especially here in Matthew 5, Jesus is actually out to deepen our understanding of what we find in the sixth commandment. If you were to compare the mind of God on the sixth commandment to a well, a water well, Jesus is trying to draw out the fullness of what's in that well, to get beneath the superficial understanding, the superficial obedience to the command, and get to the real roots of the issue, to get down into the depth, the deep structure of what the commandment is actually teaching. He's asking us to consider what's behind, or rather what's beneath, that commandment. Why is he doing that? Because the sixth commandment implies an antecedent and deeper concern. Murder is an act of the will. But murder begins in the mind. And it makes its way forward through and by the mouth. And while manslaughter isn't premeditated, its outcome is the same as murder. And therefore, the mechanism that causes harm has to be treated like the weapon that it can become, even if it wasn't intended. The gun in the hand of an assailant is just as dangerous as the gun in the hand of a five-year-old who doesn't know what he's doing. The mouth is that weapon. The heart is that weapon. And therefore, it has to be considered. That's what Jesus is getting to. Words can have murderous effect, even if they didn't have murderous intent. But what Jesus is trying to tell us here in this brief commentary on the commandment is that there is a moral and metaphysical equivalence between our words and our actions. He's going to rattle off three phrases in verse 22 that are all essentially saying the same thing. Listen to verse 22 again. I say to you, everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. Everyone who insults his brother will be liable to counsel. And whoever says, you fool, will be liable to the hell of fire. Now, let's be clear on what Jesus is calling out here. He's talking about an anger that's expressed in words. But he's not decrying anger per se. We will see Jesus in a number of instances exhibit strong passion and anger towards that which he observes for any number of reasons. So anger itself, anger just as anger, isn't the problem. There's an English proverb that maybe gives us a sense of what the anger he's talking about. The English proverb goes something like this. He is a fool who cannot be angry, but he is wise who will not remain so. Jesus is talking not about anger just in itself, but an anger that goes unattended. Left to itself, anger can and will brood. It will fester. It is like a weed that, if given a place for cultivation, it will grow until it overtakes. It is like a dog who, if left to itself, will desecrate a place. It's an anger that's without direction. And it feeds its own self, like someone who eats but not for nourishment, not for a purposeful use of energy. Unattended, anger will inevitably go somewhere, and Jesus specifies two places it can go. Anger, he says, at first will start taking shots at the capacities of another person. In the ESV there, it translates an Aramaic word into the word insult. The word in the Aramaic is raka. And if I understand its meaning correctly, it represents a pejorative comment about a person's intellect or a lack thereof. Anger unattended will naturally shift from calling out an act that may have been stupid. It will shift into actually calling that person stupid, to defining them in those terms by the action that they committed. It will demean a person in their capacities. That's where anger can go. That's one way anger can go, that it's unsupervised. There's another way it can go too that Jesus specifies. Not only will it demean their capacities, anger can end up demeaning one's moral faculties. The other word that the ESV translates there is the word fool. In the Aramaic, it's the word more, and it had to do with a person's moral fiber. See, anger, if you've ever experienced it, and I know very few of you ever have, doesn't it set off our imaginations in some ways that few things can? It sets off an imagination by inviting it to consider why would somebody do that? We've experienced that in our neighborhood this week with someone calling out something about our household, and we began to immediately imagine what kind of person would be like that. And it's like, oh, wait a minute, okay. I have no data to actually understand what might be motivating their concern, and so we had to perhaps restrain ourselves from the use of our imaginations that just sort of naturally comes to the surface. Unless something bridles the anger, unless something constrains it and guides it and keeps it in check, it will naturally begin to question the very character of another being, because passionate emotion can't be patient. So Jesus is making the point that such anger expressed in words in both those directions is just as dangerous as murder. Why? Because this unattended anger, if left to be unproductive, is the foundation for hatred. And hatred and contempt represents a shift in the mind, a shift from a disgust with an action to a disgust with a person. Hatred and contempt move past condemning actions to condemning persons. And so if there's an equivalency between words and actions, if both can be as harmful, then sure enough, brothers and sisters, there is a potency to our words that become the precursors to actions. Potency in at least three senses. Implicitly but surely, there is a potency in our words and in the effect of to whom they're directed. What we say, as you know, has an impact. Whoever coined the phrase, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me, lives in an alternative universe. Consider this comment just in a different way, in an angle. Why does God call us to not just read his word, but to meditate upon it, to muse on it, to reflect on it, to ruminate on it? Why does he do that? Because it's an act of deep consideration, in conjunction with the aid of the Spirit, that what he teaches us begins to shape us. It's what we hear, it's what we read, it's what we reflect that begins not just to inform us, but to form us. And so if that's true of that which is meant to cultivate goodness in it, then is it any wonder that what we believe tends to be what we most often hear, and therefore what we end up most meditating upon, and therefore what we hear shapes us, and therefore what we hear that might be detrimental can have a negative and detrimental effect. And we don't even know the depths to which what we've heard so often really does shape us. There's a potency in what those effects are on the people that they're directed to. But Jesus in this passage speaks of a different kind of potency also. He speaks of a potency of what words provoke from God himself. Bound up with the warning about the equivalence of words and actions is the warning of the consequence of the failure to remember that. Employing the images of law courts and the dunghill and that they would set ablaze outside Jerusalem, Jesus is saying that our words are always and everywhere under scrutiny and accountable. There are no words that aren't heard. There are no words that get a pass. Even the words spoken in secret are not secret to the presence of God. Psalm 101 says, "Those who in secret slander their neighbors, I will destroy. Those who have a haughty look and a proud heart, I cannot abide." Words are potent, Jesus is saying, in what they provoke from God. But thirdly, there's a potency to our words, not just in whom they're directed to or from what is provoked from God himself, but there's a potency also in those who speak them, what it does to them. There's a quote on the front of your bulletin from Martin Luther King Jr. You know him, you know his history, you know he had been the recipient, the victim of malign words and malign actions, but as the victim of both, he knew the commonality between words and actions. He'd felt hatred in the blows, but he'd seen hatred in the looks and heard hatred in the words, and that's why he could say with authority, "Hate is always tragic. It is as injurious to the hater as it is to the hated. It distorts the personality. It scars the soul. And every time I see it, I say to myself, hate is too great a burden to bear." And brothers and sisters, it bubbles up in us and it thinks it only affects those that we might be actually expressing it to. But brothers and sisters, it doesn't. It is a self-inflicted wound. It diminishes the heart as it wearies it. Pure hatred, you see, requires that you have to flatten out the image of the person that you have a problem with. You have to create this caricature of them, and you have to admit no detail that might nuance your estimation of them. That's exhausting. There's rest that Jesus is offering in us by saying, don't let murderous words come across your lips. Because if you do, it means that you are having to concoct a version of them that is so tiring. And it distorts you as well as it demeans them. And that's one reason why some psychologists today speak of those who are suffering from PTSD. They will say that those who suffer from that cannot heal unless they rehumanize those that they formerly dehumanized in battle. One psychologist wrote, "Restoring honor to the enemy is an essential step in the recovery from combat. While other things are obviously needed as well, the veteran's self-respect never fully recovers so long as he is unable to see the enemy as worthy." In the words of one of our patients, a war against subhuman vermin, quote, has no honor. This is true even in victory, in defeat. The dishonoring makes life unendurable. Fascinating. Unless and until one's hatred or malign of the enemy is diminished, one remains a casualty of a war that they can't let go of. Walter Wink put the seduction of hatred this way. We want desperately to believe that our forcible retaliation to evil is like a projectile fired from a gun that will drop evil in its tracks. In fact, it is more like a ball thrown by a pitcher that will, as likely as not, come back at us or over the fence. Our responsibility to one another is to respect the potency of our words. That's the first point. But that first point has an underlying premise. And that underlying premise is the second point. And it has to do with the identity, both of who is speaking and who is being spoken to. Jesus outlines our responsibility to one another not only by speaking of the potency of our words, but it's also of making a case for the dignity of humanity. A murderous word in the mouth is like a dangerous weapon in the hand, but the concern of that only makes sense if the object of the word has any significance. If you shoot a fence post, the worst you can do to it is splinter it. But if you shoot another, it is a qualitatively different act. Why? Because of the value of your target. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights asserted the intrinsic value of the human person, and it references it by a word that we're all familiar with. It's the word dignity. But like I talked about in the backstory, there are understandable and pragmatic reasons why the Declaration didn't spend any time grounding that identity, making a case for the reality of dignity. But the Sixth Commandment and Jesus are making that case implicitly. What determines the dignity of an individual? It's not their name. It's not their pedigree. It's not their adjusted gross income. It's not their accomplishments. The Bible teaches that man's dignity, men, women, and children's irrevocable value is established by one thing. They are fashioned in the very image of God, who is the glory of all things. Genesis 1:26 makes it pretty clear. Let us make man in our own image. A lot of things we could extrapolate from those several words. But what it means is that you and I owe our very existence and form to the conception and execution of a God who ascribes to us worth like that which we ascribe to famous works of art, literature, technology. Each artifact is judged on its own merits, but each has an indissoluble quality to it because of whose mind and will the artifact originated from. God values what he conceives. God values what he fashions. My kids, for good or for ill, love making projects all the time. My house is now a fire hazard. There are works of theirs that line their schoolroom that are now in the attic. And should any one of them be harmed or befouled, tears are shed. What they made is part of them. To desecrate it is, in some sense, to offend them. It's to desecrate them. How much more is that true of God? If we defame that which is made by extension of him, how much more are we offending his sensibilities? Now, one might say that it is a waste of time for us to argue for what everyone already acknowledges in saying that humanity has an intrinsic dignity that cannot be revoked. But look, not everyone acknowledges that dignity. If they did, the murder rate would fall to zero and wars would stop tomorrow. And two, as I also referenced in the backstory this week, there is a strong intellectual undercurrent that is becoming more and more prevalent that would just as soon we dispensed with the entire category of dignity. That, as one pretty famed psychologist put it, dignity is an awfully squishy term, untenable and unhelpful in working out a theory of ethics. And therefore, I put on your bulletin a quote from Charles Darwin, not as a criticism of his science, but to unpack where his theory must ultimately lead if you take it to its logical conclusion. He once wrote, "A man who has no assured and ever-present belief in the existence of a personal God or a future existence with retribution and reward can have for his rule of life, as far as I can see, only to follow those impulses and instincts which are the strongest or which seem to him the best ones." Without a theory of human dignity, One may follow the impulses that may seem best to you, even if it means annihilating those whose impulses you do not find tenable. And does not our history reflect that sensibility? But like we said a couple weeks ago, even if you try to expunge from the world the idea of the transcendent order that would establish human dignity, the notion of the sacred keeps trying to find its way into human discourse. We can't quite shake it. We can't give up the notion that there might be something more to us than just matter. And that's why you will hear from our advisor to the National Security Council this week when she's talking about that last remaining prisoner of war that was released. She said, "We have a sacred obligation that we have upheld since the founding of our republic to do our utmost to bring back our men and women who are taken in battle, and we did that in this instance." Our president, in response to that whole situation, said, "The United States has always had a pretty sacred rule, and that is we don't leave our men or women behind in uniform. Regardless of the circumstances that may turn out to be, we still get an American soldier back if he's held in captivity." Period. Full stop. Sacred. They said sacred. You don't use that word haphazardly unless you're appealing to something that's beyond this world. Now, that story about that soldier has yet to be told in full clarity, but what we've seen this week is emblematic of how the idea of the sacred keeps creeping back in, and also how the dignity of human person lies not in his actions, but in his nature. Not in your actions, in your nature. You heard in the last point about how soldiers don't heal from PTSD until they rehumanize their enemy. And we think that might be a new revelation, but it's not that new. In fact, it's been around for quite a long time. On the day that Lee surrendered to Grant near Appomattox Courthouse, a shout of revelry went up from the Union soldiers, delighting in the defeat of the South. And General Grant called the shouting to a halt. And he wrote in his memoir, "I felt like anything rather than rejoicing at the downfall of a foe who had fought so long and valiantly and had suffered so much for a cause, though that cause was, I believe, one of the worst for which a people ever fought, and one for which there was the least excuse. I do not question, however, the sincerity of the great mass of those who were opposed to us. The Confederates were now our prisoners and our countrymen, and we did not want to exult over their downfall." The fog of war lifted, the light shone on the faces of men who'd only been known as an enemy, and that light revealed their dignity. Dignity as conferred by not what was not of this earth. Brothers and sisters, when you're mad at somebody, do you see them like Grant saw his enemy? Or do you only see them as an enemy? Calvin summarizes the sixth commandment, putting it this way: "Man is both in the image of God and our flesh. And therefore, if we would not violate the image of God, we must hold the person of man sacred. And if we would not divest ourselves of humanity, we must cherish our own flesh." We've said that our responsibility to one another requires that we recognize the potency of our words and the dignity of humanity. But Jesus teaches us one last thing that logically follows from those two points. And it has to do with the priority of reconciliation. That's my last point. The rest of Jesus' teaching centers on the inevitable moment when we discover or realize or lament that we have maligned someone else by our words. When we've let anger spill over into something that's almost like murderous language and let the hatred trip over our tongues. What do you do when you find that we've let our words become weapons? Jesus is saying, rather clearly and uncomplicatedly, that insofar as you are able, you have to move urgently and resolutely to make amends. The peace and the purity of the church depends on it. And your witness in the world depends on it, he is saying. And that's why Jesus paints two scenarios, one for within the church and one for without it. In the first scenario, one has somebody bringing their sacrifice into the temple, which is kind of an ironic statement for Jesus because he says the first commandment we learn from the Decalogue is that we shall have no other gods before me. And yet Jesus is saying God holds reconciliation so highly that that should take priority even over our expressions of piety and sacrifice or ritual observance. We said last week that honoring our parents and worshiping God are inextricably bound. The same is true here. Reconciliation with others is inextricably bound up with what it means to worship God. If we're all to worship God with one voice, then we will have to seek to be as one with each other. The peace and the purity of the church depend on it. Is that your commitment? When you took the fifth vow of membership to join this church, you sought to study the peace and the purity of the church, and implicit within that is that you sought to live as one voice with one another here. The peace and the purity of the church depend on it, and our witness in the world depends on it. And that's why Jesus paints another scenario of one who's been accused of a misstep or a misdemeanor or worse, and unless our priority to set things right quickly, we only risk a worse outcome for our delay. And even worse, when we fail or when we delay to make amends, the world looks on and holds up our integrity with even more incredulity. If you haven't paid the bill yet, brothers and sisters, pay the bill. If you haven't kept the promise yet, keep the promise or at least ask forgiveness for the delay. Those are two reasons why Jesus and the Lord put such a priority on reconciliation. But given what we know about Jesus' full story, God's concern for interpersonal harmony is grounded in a deeper concern. The estrangement that exists between people derives from what's within people. As Jesus put it in our confession of sin this morning, the good person out of the good treasure of his heart produces good. The evil person out of his evil treasure produces evil. For out of the abundance of his heart, the mouth speaks. And therefore, to make amends with another is to attend not just to the words or to the relationship, but to one's heart. And you know that. But does that sober you? Yehiel Denour survived the concentration camps in World War II, and he was a witness against Adolf Eichmann in the Nuremberg trials shortly thereafter. And on the day that he would testify in the presence of Adolf Eichmann, Eichmann walked into the courtroom, and Denour began to shake and to convulse until finally he fainted on the floor. Decades later, Denour would give an interview to Mike Wallace on 60 Minutes. And in that interview, Wallace asked Denour, "Why did you faint? Were you overcome by fear, hatred, horrid memories?" And Denour answered, which is on the front of your bulletin, "No, it was none of these. Rather, all at once, I realized Eichmann was not the godlike army officer who had sent so many to their deaths. This Eichmann was an ordinary man. I was afraid about myself. I saw that I'm capable to do this. I am exactly like he. Eichmann is in all of us." That which is in the architect of mass extermination is in the heart of a disaffected youth shooting people randomly in California, is in the heart of someone at Seattle Pacific University this week, is in the heart of you and me. Eichmann is in all of us, he says. And therefore, what Jesus asks of us in this passage, he first has to do for us. In fact, what he asks of us depends on what he first does for us. Our priority for reconciliation is grounded and established in his. Jesus suffers murderous words and acts in order to deliver us from the just condemnation of God. He sacrifices his right to be addressed with respect in order to secure for us the commendation of God. Jesus dies for us to confirm the dignity of humanity. And then, by His grace, through His Spirit, He grants us the strength to become peacemakers in the world. See, all those other world realities that I've just rattled off for you, they have very this-worldly implications. What He does to reconcile us to God by His blood is what enables us to reconcile ourselves to one another, if only we will trust that His reconciliation is true. Because the anger that leads to murderous words arises from a variety of places. But there are two usual suspects, two that we probably reference quite often around here. One is pride. Pride that takes a certain delight in defaming someone else. It doesn't even have to use explicit antagonisms. It can be just a tone or a silence or a brooding, which can be just as caustic and as foul as any scabrous word you might have ever hurled in a flurry. It can find that enterprise delicious. But the gospel of Jesus Christ humbles that pride. The cross of Jesus undercuts any justification that you might have to hate, because if the cross is true, then there is no place for superiority that amplifies disgust into condemnation. No place for it. Anger comes from pride, and Jesus answers it by His cross, but anger also comes from fear. When one is threatened, one is tempted to lash out in defense to protect oneself by unleashing a barrage of language. It believes that unless I defend myself caustically, I am ruined myself, and fear can wreak as much havoc as pride ever sought to. But the gospel consoles that fear. If we are His forever by His grace, then no matter how much other men might defame us, Christ is our defense, not our words dripping with fearful animosity. Do you see how the gospel has to become preeminent in your thinking if you're ever to preempt or tamp down what bubbles up so easily in our hearts? And so by way of application, let me roll it out for you this way. Let me ask you, with whom might you be at odds right now? What is within your power to restore that which has been broken? For some of you, what this text invites, it's calling you to practice silence more often. You are impulsive, and your impulsiveness leads you to say things that you will kick yourself later for saying. Sometimes you just got to be quiet. But for others of you, this text is calling you to speak up, lest you let what disgusts you and your brooding lead to something worse than just grinding your teeth. To everything there is a season, and to each of us, different seasons call for different responses. If our words betray our hearts, what do they reveal about yours? What eats at you such that it leads you to chafe habitually at others? What's there that you're not yet facing? How does the gospel answer that anger-causing concern? That's the application. It's by reflection and musing on His redemption. Let me close with the words from Maya Angelou, who you may know died this week. What I didn't know, what you may not have known, is that she was raped at the age of 8. And that with the exception of her brother, she spoke to no one for 5 years. But in a poem she wrote called Pulse of the Morning, it says, "Do not be wedded forever to fear, yoked eternally to brutishness. You may shoot me with your words, you may cut me with your eyes, you may kill me with your hatefulness, but still, like air, I'll rise." Maya Angelou speaks to us of a hope that overcomes hate, both within and without. But Jesus Christ gives us a reason to believe it and the strength to uphold it. And then our responsibilities to one another become a privilege. For in them and with them, we find and give life. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, amen.